There are the haves and the have-nots, right? The have-nots in this pandemic are dealing with pressing financial needs, rent, food, safety. And many of the haves, they have a lot. And a lot of them, I will say, a lot of them are making a big effort to give generously and to give wisely to make the world a better place. And that's going to be the focus of this conversation. David Wells is the founder of Family Capital Strategy, and he's the author of a book called When Anything is Possible, Wealth and the Art of Strategic Living. He joins us now from Nashville, Tennessee. Hello there.
Hey, how's it going, Bruce?
Great. I think what I love about this topic is it's a bit of a jog left in our conversation about personal finance and financial wellness. So much of it is focused on those who are having a really, really hard time. And this book is about those who are not having a hard time in that way. In fact, they have wealth in abundance. Tell us why you wanted to write this book.
Yeah, I love your intro because it seems so counterintuitive right now because there are people who are suffering so tremendously in this pandemic that just kind of keeps going on. And then the flip side is that there are people who are becoming or are wealthier than they ever imagined. Mm. And so my time in and around the investment space and then working with ultra high net worth, really wealthy families, I think folks who end up in those circumstances, it's kind of like the dog who catches the bus. It's not necessarily something that they planned on. It's something that happens to them. And as a result, there's just a whole bunch of questions that arise. And I think the natural reaction is almost like a fear-based response of like, I don't want to screw up the tremendous responsibility of this wealth. Yeah. But where do I go from here? And it can be so overwhelming. And so the book was like, how can I give people a framework to begin to digest this new reality that they find themselves in?
And I can imagine many of them are the recipients of a near endless stream of requests that if they don't immediately say yes to everything makes them feel bad or raises the ire of the askers, particularly if they're close. So you use this phrase, the art of strategic living. What does strategic living mean in your view?
Yeah. So in my mind, it's kind of goes back to like what Socrates said, which was that the unexamined life is not worth living. And so I think for people who have means and wealth, it's how do you begin to think strategically, which is how do I look out in the future, identify my priorities, and then make sure that the steps that I'm taking today are in alignment with what's most important to me. And it's beginning to be more thoughtful as opposed to either reactive to things, or I think most people with money just, you know, they don't even, it's just money comes in, money goes out. You know, you buy something on Amazon, you don't give it a whole lot of thought. So it's beginning to introduce a little bit more consciousness to the decisions that you're making so that it's aligned with what you think is most important in the world.
Speaking of Amazon, and I love that you focus on this example because it's so resonant for people, is Jeff Bezos's former wife, Mackenzie Scott, has a lot of money. Tell us about her approach.
Yeah, I think she's a fascinating case study of someone who I think has gotten this really right. And if you look at her philanthropic activity, and she's given away on the order of like $6 to $7 billion in the last 9 months or so. And it's giving money away is on that scale is really challenging. And what I think is really unique about her approach is she took, my guess is she has a real clear view of what she wants to accomplish. And then in a very short order period of time, because of, you know, the real nature of the crisis, she was able to identify and vet hundreds of organizations that met her criteria. And then she gave the gift of giving to operating budgets or to endowments, to things where it wasn't about a building with her name on it. It was, hey, this organization has a model for change, for bringing improvement in the world. What would it look like if somebody came in and really supercharged what they did?
How would you look at the steps of how one brings strategic living to life? Is there an A, a B, a C, and a D?
Yes, I think of it in three steps. So the first is kind of like you lay out the goal lines of the soccer pitch. It's the what is the structure of your wealth? So what is it that you actually own? And at the financial level, you know, that's your balance sheet. It's the, you know, the assets and liabilities. But I think you even need to expand that to think about what are the other pieces of wealth, you know, the relationships that you have, the human investment, your education, the skills that you've developed over the years, the things in society that you're passionate about. So it's getting a real landscape of, okay, this is all of my assets, financial and otherwise. So that's part one. Part two is a little squishier, and I term it wealth identity, but it really comes down to this question of, okay, what are the messages that I've received about wealth and its responsibility? How have I internalized those? And then how do I begin to think about my own mission statement, if you will, you know, vision statements, core values, the things that are most important to me, and how does who I am and what I want to accomplish in the world align with the messaging that I've received growing up? I think so many of us internalize things and we never actually articulate it because it's kind of like lenses we wear on our glasses. We just see the world this way, but we don't realize that maybe we're colorblind or something like that. Mm. Once you've got those two pieces of structure and identity, now you can really tee up this question of strategy. And the simple fact is there's really only four things you can do with your money. You can consume it, you know, you can invest it, you can give to future generations within your family, and then you can give to philanthropic causes. I mean, I guess there's a fifth thing that you can do with your money, which is pay taxes, but I generally have not found people to like voluntarily
really
sign up
excited
to do more
about
of that.
Yeah. Woo, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really those big four. And I think what's really interesting is, especially with consumption, I think that gets a lot of the lion's share time of attention is like, how much am I spending? And then how much am I investing? I think most people, once they know that their needs are provided for, then the mindset really shifts to, okay, what am I trying to do within my family? And are there ways to support future generations? And then what's the responsibility that I have to those around me, to the community that I grew up in, to the needs in the world, whether it's, you know, education, healthcare, climate change, the things that I think are really important. And how do I, you know, what can I do with my little piece of the world to make a difference with some of these problems that are out there?
It is easier to make a link to between our values and organizations. So you value education and you choose organizations. What seems to be much more difficult is how to assess the efficacy of the recipient in that values-driven sector, for example. Like, is what's one education charity versus another? They could have very, very different, a very, very different ability to affect change in the world. How do wealthy families ensure that their money is well spent in that regard?
I think that's a great question. And I think you see it falling out in a couple of ways. You know, for some families, it's, you know, they write a check and then they also roll up their sleeves. And so that may mean they're serving in the boardroom of the organization, they're volunteering. You know, there's a way to stay involved to kind of see how things are going. I think for some folks, that's a really natural pathway for things that they're passionate about. Honestly, I find a lot of families, they follow other families. And so, you know, if they take education, for example, if that's something that you're passionate about, but you don't have either the time or resources to really build like a team at your family foundation, they may find other families who they think are doing it well and kind of coattail ride and say, look, these folks are doing a great job. Like, it's kind of what Warren Buffett did with Bill Gates. He looked at Bill Gates and said, look, Gates has got this thing figured out. Why don't I just supercharge him with another, you know, couple, 20, 30, $40 billion
right,
and just like and allow him to do more of what good work he's already doing. So I think that's it's an easier way to do it. And then, you know, to some extent, you know, you take a risk, right? Like, I think that's the challenge. If social problems were easy to solve, then we would have addressed them a long time ago. And so to some extent, it's, you know, you have to spread a lot of bets. You've got to look at a lot of different theories of change and then figure out and over time see, like, is the population set that this charity is addressing and the need that it's addressing, is it actually getting the work done? Or is there a better mousetrap that's come along? And I think what we've seen even in the last like number of years is that technology and other things are bringing attention to issues and are allowing new models to develop that are more effective than things that we've had in the past.
Really interesting stuff, David. Thank you for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks, Bruce. It's my pleasure.
David Wells is the author of When Anything Is Possible, a new take on what some of the wealthiest among us are doing to make the world a better place.